This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We've talked a lot about genetic testing on this program over the past year or so. The amount of data that can come from the human genome seems to be growing each day. And there are companies that are using that data to market genetic tests for home use.
The main point about direct-to-consumer tests is that these tests can be purchased and results can be received without any input from a healthcare provider.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a test called 23andMe and find out why the FDA has banned it from being used as a genetic health screen in the U.S. We'll also spend some time outside a classroom as a school fights what it calls nature deficit syndrome. And we'll spend an academic minute with garbled communications on social media. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Last week, officials from the United Kingdom Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency approved the use of the commercial genomic test called 23andMe to help patients screen for potential health issues they may or may not face in the future. That decision is in stark contrast with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which last November told the company to immediately discontinue marketing 23andMe in the U.S. for the purpose of genetic health screening. The company still offers DNA testing and analysis, but no longer provides new consumers with genetic interpretations that relate to health. The ban was in response to 23andMe's failure to respond to questions that the FDA had about the analytical and clinical validity of the test. While some support the FDA's actions because of the test's potential for harm to consumers, some advocates of the technology fault the FDA for being overly paternalistic in impeding medical advances. In the June 2014 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, an opinion article asks if the FDA is violating the First Amendment or protecting the rights of consumers. The author of that article, Dr. Linnea Bodwin, is assistant professor of laboratory medicine and pathology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and co-director of the Personalized Genomics Laboratory, Cardiovascular Laboratory Medicine, and the Clinical Genomic Sequencing Laboratory at the clinic. I spoke to Dr. Bodwin about direct-to-consumer genetic testing and specifically the 23andMe Personal Genomic Service Test.
Well, traditionally, genetic tests have been available only through healthcare providers. But direct-to-consumer genetic tests take a different approach in that they are genetic tests that are actually marketed directly to consumers and can be ordered directly by consumers. And if a consumer chooses to purchase a genetic test directly, what happens is that the test kit is mailed to the consumer, and then the consumer submits a sample back to the company. This may be a saliva sample or a blood sample or a buccal swab. And then once the testing is complete, consumers are notified of their results by mail, phone, or online. And so really the main point about direct-to-consumer tests is that these tests can be purchased and results can be received without any input from a healthcare provider. In the case of 23andMe, they have a personal genome service test, or also known as PGS test. And this is a $99 saliva-based direct-to-consumer genetic test. And the PGS test looks for 254 health conditions and traits, which include genetic disorders that are inherited in a Mendelian fashion. Take, for example, hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. They include complex disorders with at least a partial genetic basis, for example, atrial fibrillation. And they also include traits that may have at least a partial genetic basis, for example, propensity to heroin addiction. And 23andMe, they require a saliva sample from the consumer for the test. And then once the testing is completed, the company provides the test results back to the consumer through a secure online portal. The results provided by 23andMe include the genetic variants that have been detected. And prior to the FDA order to 23andMe to cease marketing its test, the results also included interpretive reports that contain risks for developing certain conditions.
Well, let's talk about that. In November 2013, the FDA did order 23andMe to cease marketing its personal genome service test. Why did they do that, and what are the controversies surrounding this decision by the FDA?
To give you a little background to set the stage, in 2012, 23andMe actually filed for FDA 510K clearance for their test. So essentially, they were asking the FDA to put its stamp of approval on the test. In order to do that, the FDA requires that certain criteria are met by the company, including proof of analytical and clinical validity. So the FDA said that since the filing in 2012 by 23andMe, the company had failed to respond to questions the agency had about the validity of the test. And in the letter that they sent to 23andMe on November 22, 2013, the FDA Office of In Vitro Diagnostics and Radiological Health Director, Alberto Gutierrez, stated that his office was particularly concerned about assessments for certain inherited disorder and pharmacogenetic tests because of potential risks associated with false positive or false negative assessments. And he said that their office had provided ample feedback about the kinds of data it required, but the company had not yet provided adequate answers. So Gutierrez said that the FDA had already, and I quote, spent significant time evaluating the intended uses of the PGS test to decide whether or not it could be classified as a Class 2 device or whether it required pre-market approval. He also said that the FDA had proposed modifications to the PGS labeling that could mitigate any risks. But then he went on to say in the letter, and I quote, however, even after these many interactions with 23andMe, we still do not have any assurance that the firm has analytically or clinically validated the PGS for its intended uses, which have expanded from the uses that the firm identified in its submissions. Prior to this letter, 23andMe had told the FDA early in 2013 that it was completing additional analytical and clinical validations and was also planning other studies that would take months to complete. However, as of the time of the FDA letter in November, Gutierrez said his office still had not received the information it was seeking from 23andMe. So not surprisingly, the FDA's order to 23andMe to cease marketing its test has been met with controversy. On the one hand, some are arguing that the government is out of line for shutting down this direct-to-consumer test, and they say that the FDA is being overly paternalistic and that consumers really should have direct access to their genetic information if they want it. They also cite studies that show that consumers have only transient anxiety, if any at all, when they receive their test results. And they also show studies that show that, for the most part, consumers do not act on their genomic information without obtaining healthcare provider input first. Some individuals who support the side of the controversy are even claiming that the FDA is violating the First Amendment rights of consumers on two levels. First, by violating the rights of individuals to receive information, and second, by violating the rights of 23andMe to advertise their test. And this advertisement is a form of speech known as commercial speech. But there is an opposing school of thought, and that's that the FDA is actually protecting customers from receiving misinformation from the PGS test. And this is because the 23andMe PGS test is considered a medical device. 23andMe did apply for 510K clearance, and therefore this test is under the purview of the FDA. And the bottom line is that 23andMe has not provided sufficient evidence that their test is analytically or clinically valid.
Well, let's go to those magic words you just said, analytically and clinically valid. What do you mean by that, and why is it important in this case?
So to define these terms, analytic validity is essentially how well the test predicts the presence or absence of a particular gene or genetic change. In other words, can the test accurately detect whether a specific genetic variant is present or absent? And clinical validity, the second term, is how well a genetic variant being analyzed is related to the presence, absence, or risk of a specific disease or condition. And there is another term that's important to know, and that's clinical utility. And clinical utility is essentially whether the test can provide information about the diagnosis, treatment, management, or prevention of a disease that will be helpful to a consumer. So to reiterate, the reason that these terms are important to this case is that, according to the FDA, 23andMe had failed to adequately respond to the FDA regarding their questions about the validity of the intended uses of its PGS test.
Doctor, in your opinion, are there features of this test that are clinically valuable? And, well, isn't $99 for genetic tests for 254 health traits and conditions almost a bargain?
You know, that's a great question. And really some aspects of this test could be considered an exceptional value, especially for the clinically actionable pieces of the test. For example, the inherited disorders part of the test, which includes analysis for carrier status for over 50 conditions, is a value when you consider that ordering each test individually would cost a great deal more than $99. However, a huge caveat is that this panel includes only a small percentage of possible pathogenic mutations. And these are usually founder mutations found only in specific populations, and they really don't account for much of that disease's risk. There's also a group of tests included in the PGS that are listed as, quote, health risks. And these health risks are also incomplete, and they utilize unvalidated algorithms to provide a risk score. What these health risks are is over 120 disorders of known polygenic and multifactorial etiology. And some examples include atrial fibrillation, celiac disease, and restless leg syndrome. And for many of these disorders, there are many known associated risk markers, but the PGS test may only look at a handful of the markers. Additionally, an unvalidated algorithm is used to provide a risk score, or absolute risk, or health risk, as 23andMe calls it. And this is the probability that the individual being tested will develop a condition. One criticism of this model is that the final average lifetime risk is dependent on which variables, for example, age, gender, ethnicity, are used to define population, and this often varies among direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies. Another criticism of the algorithm used is that there is a lack of weighting of risk markers, and also sometimes genomic markers that have risk values that are too small to be statistically valid are included. So taken together, these unvalidated risk analyses and incomplete testing is what has led to reports of individuals who have had their testing done at more than one direct-to-consumer company, and they've received highly disparate reports of their risk.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Linnea Bodwin continues with a look at why the FDA thinks consumers can't be trusted with their genetic information. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Well, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1264. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Linnea Bodwin, Assistant Professor of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and co-director of the Personalized Genomics Laboratory, Cardiovascular Laboratory Medicine, and the Clinical Genome Sequencing Laboratory at the clinic. We're talking about the at-home genetic test 23andMe. Some published reports have said that most patients will not change healthcare actions based on the genomic data without first consulting a physician. Now, this is the case. Why can't consumers be trusted to obtain their genomic information directly from companies and then consult a physician downstream if they need to?
Well, that's also a good question, and there are really two major criticisms of this model. The first is that the majority of users of direct-to-consumer genomic tests are highly educated and have easy access to health care. So their background and access to healthcare will enable them to seek out professional input on any concerning test results. There is major concern, though, that even with this easy access to healthcare, consumers likely apply subjective interpretations of genetic risk data, and they may not fully understand the clinical validity or utility or limitations of their test results. The second criticism of this is that most medical providers readily admit that they are hardly any more prepared than the general consumer to understand these reports. In fact, one study observed that 85% of primary care physicians did not feel prepared to answer patients' questions on direct-to-consumer testing. The majority of physicians in this study also had concerns about direct-to-consumer testing, leading to incorrect interpretation of results by patients, misleading advertisements, and questionable clinical utility. Another study found that 92% of genetic counselors perceived that patients were at risk of receiving misinformation from DTC tests. And an overwhelming 96% of them would not recommend DTC genetic testing to their patients. So the implications of all these criticisms are the potential strains that this type of test could place on the healthcare system due to the need for increased resources to educate medical providers to help them understand these unvalidated reports, and also the increased workload of healthcare providers to educate consumers about their test results.
Finally, Doctor, let's look ahead. What does the future hold for 23andMe and other direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies?
You know, I'm really positive about this, and I think that there can and should be a place for these types of companies and tests in the marketplace. As we pointed out, these tests tend to be very affordable, and they can provide some very valuable, clinically actionable information. However, like all laboratories that provide genetic testing or any clinical testing for that matter, direct-to-consumer companies should focus on providing tests that will benefit the consumer. They should look at providing a more selective and clinically actionable testing menu, and that should decrease the burden placed on healthcare providers when consumers bring their test results to them. Direct-to-consumer testing companies should also provide a mechanism to educate consumers and healthcare providers about their test, as well as help to facilitate communication between consumers and healthcare providers. And finally, I think that direct-to-consumer testing companies should be as transparent as possible about the limitations of their test in order to avoid confusion and potentially mislead the consumer.
Dr. Linnea Bodwin is Assistant Professor of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and co-director of the Personalized Genomics Laboratory, Cardiovascular Laboratory Medicine, and the Clinical Genome Sequencing Laboratory at the clinic. You can read Dr. Bodwin's article on 23andMe in the June 2014 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Think back to when you were a kid and how much time you spent playing outside. Now think about the kids on your block or in your house today. How much time do you see them exploring the neighborhood? You may have noticed that your kids or your neighbor's kids spend less time than ever outdoors, but there are programs that are working to fight what's been called nature deficit disorder. Michigan Radio's Sarah Hewlett looks at one of them.
This group of sixth graders at C.A. Frost Environmental Sciences Academy in Grand Rapids starts class the way most students everywhere do, inside, at tables, looking at photocopied sheets of paper and taking direction from their science teacher, Mary Lewandowski.
All right, so raise your hand when you're ready to go out and you can tell me what you got to do.
But once they've got their assignments, they head out the door to a retention pond out back where they've got to figure out where they are.
If this was south, go look for it. Then this was east.
Then they fan out around the pond to complete their assignments. Actually, some of them are in the pond.
We're measuring the temperature of the water.
We got to get the bugs out. And
yeah, we have to check.
We have to feel it.
In some ways, this school is special. It sits right next to a nature preserve, so teachers can take kids on hikes that feel like they're far from the city, when in fact they're not. But in other ways, it's just an ordinary urban public school. Kids don't have to test to get in. Close to two-thirds of students get free or reduced lunch. And the fact that this school is open to any student in Grand Rapids is important to Pam Wells Marcus.
Hi, Ms. Wells.
Hi, good to see you.
Wells is retired now, sort of. She was the principal here for 18 years and still spends a lot of time here. She can't walk 3 feet without a student coming up to her for a hug or to show her a scraped knee. Wells says when she and her colleagues decided to make this an environment-themed school about a decade ago, they wanted it to be a refuge of sorts.
What this school provides to children is a place where they can breathe, where they can notice and observe, where they can be still.
Wells says that's a need all kids have, but she says it's especially true in poor urban neighborhoods.
It's not safe to go for walks. It's not safe to go around the block. It's not maybe safe to play in parks and to go in fields and to hang around.
And when kids don't get to spend time in nature, well, studies suggest a link to things like obesity, attention problems, even depression. And on the flip side, there's research that shows something else.
Which is, you can be happier and healthier and maybe even smarter if you get outside into nature more.
That's Richard Louv. He came up with the term nature deficit disorder and wrote about it in his 2005 book, Last Child in the Woods. Louv says schools have helped contribute to the problem.
Many schools have canceled or eliminated recess. Physical education has been cut. Field trips in many schools are a thing of the past. So there's a long list of barriers.
Back at C.A. Frost Elementary in Grand Rapids, teacher Greg Peterson is wrangling a bunch of third graders on a trail in back of the school.
First, wait. Double line right here.
There's a freewheeling element to this kind of teaching. Peterson's got to get these kids to learn what the curriculum says they need to know and what they'll be tested on.
Tell me, what do these leaves do? Rebecca, can you talk loud so we can hear?
But nature keeps getting in the way.
Hey, friends, look at this special kind of hawk. It's called a Cooper's hawk. I can't believe this view we're getting. Look at this.
The school seems to be doing something right. C.A. Frost outperformed the district on the state standardized test in most grades and subjects by a wide margin. And the school may be setting these kids up for a love of the outdoors they can take with them for the rest of their lives. With State of Opportunity, I'm Sarah Hewlett, Michigan Radio News.
Remember that old game, Telephone, where people repeated a message over and over to see how garbled the real meaning became? Well, it seems that's the way social media works, too. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Not all information receives equal treatment online. Brian Southwell, research professor of mass communication and health behavior at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, examines the unevenness of disseminating anything via social media.
Pundits talk about the 21st century as the full flowering of the information age. Central to such thinking is the grand promise of peer-to-peer information sharing. Instead of being limited to a one-to-many broadcast era in which a few broadcasters reach large audiences, information now can be expressed from many-to-many 24 hours a day. Many people particularly celebrate the possibilities of social media to teach people in the 21st century. Although there are new possibilities in our midst, however, we also need to be thoughtful in moving forward based on empirical evidence. Rather than encouraging equity in what we all know and think, reliance on social networks to spread information may be a recipe for inequity. An increasing body of research suggests people are not equal in their tendency to share information with others. Some of those differences represent disparity. Information sharing is constrained unjustly by factors outside of a person's control. Consider work colleagues and I did a few years ago to leverage peer networks for referral to a free mammography program. Only a small group of women actually did almost all the referring. A few people referred many, most referred none. Information also doesn't spread equally. Many of us are familiar with the ubiquity of furry kitten pictures forwarded online. Similarly, researchers have found emotionally evocative and sensational material travels further and more frequently than does other material. All of this matters as we increasingly see an information landscape shaped by what is shared. Everyone does not play an equal role, and some messages are easier to spread than others. Addressing those inequities will require continued research. Social media are abundant now, but do not eliminate our old human tendencies and constraints.
That was Brian Southwell of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.